something wrong with the printer, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
I've been trying to get... Okay, maybe it's working now. Let's try.
I printed the diagram around four copies.
Oh, okay, yeah, I saw that.
Oh, that's great, yeah.
You can check it later.
Okay, so this is what we discussed last time.
Conceptually.
Mm-hmm. And that's nice. I like all the symbols that you separated out. So the goal is to have something similar for rights, and maybe some parts of the diagram can, you know, can be borrowed from the reads. That I want.
Right. What I expect, in fact, is the function calls, which are basically the actual reads from cache or from the SSD, be expanded on a larger block diagram.
Okay.
And we'll have this intersection with, you know, operations on the right. Right. I'm talking about these boxes that have these vertical lines on the edges, left and right. So those are essentially reads that may conflict with other operations like writes and garbage collection operations. And so I'm thinking that some of that logic will be also as well shared with the RAF.
Okay.
The conflicts are going to be the same. I mean, we're trying to use the same memory, or we're trying to access, let's say, the same data register for a plane that for reads and writes. And we need to introduce some mechanism that will reflect that latency, or that type of locking mechanism would be, in some sense.
Sure. So let's walk through this picture once a little bit.
If you want to start from the pen.
Or if you... Okay, maybe we can start with what Lewis has, and then we can go to this.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
let me go get the printout.
Right.
Question about the football. Is that you went to the football on the fourth, right?
A volleyball.
A volleyball.
Volleyball.
I thought it was football.
No, the 4th of July was the volleyball and at UN.
Okay.
Not here.
Is this an easy way to get football tickets?
It's free for students. I think for faculty as well should be.
Right. Yeah. I'm just trying to where to get them
from GC. Usually from the information desk. That's one place, or otherwise it's on GC, third floor. The room number, I don't remember, but there's an
office
that calls events.
Is this for football or soccer?
Football.
Football.
Yeah,
football.
American football.
American
football. Oh, okay. Because I'm thinking of it.
Yeah.
I call football.
I don't think we have a soccer team, right? Do we?
I don't think so. Yeah. There's female. There's female soccer.
Soccer,
team.
Really?
I'm just thinking about starting to take my kids to sports events.
Yeah, that's
starting from something really cheap. Like FIU sports events.
Yeah, I think you can get more than one ticket, definitely, because, I mean, it's not even like full all the time, right? And they give away tickets.
Yeah, I'll definitely check it out.
I'm guessing football is the best here in terms of show and,
in terms of what?
Of show.
Of interest, like, especially. I mean, the most popular sport is football in general.
Oh, yeah.
And here at FIU, it's number one, although the football team is not top. It's not the top team.
They want some games.
In the league.
So do you have a copy already?
I have one copy.
So
I have a bunch of new graphs here. Fortunately, I didn't have the data for all the experiments. So, in fact, I'm planning to repeat many of the experiments, and I'm hoping that the experiments are fast. So
okay.
It should be fine. So let me see. For now, I just plugged the graph for the data I already have, so I can do any experiment, solution experiment to this graph. So I think, okay, so the first set of graphs is, well, the other thing is that I made them big, so so I guess the first set of experiments is about the write bind request rate, which I already have some experiments on. The other set of experiments is with random sequential write, which is section number 7.
Are you talking about the new experiments or?
No, I'm talking about the graphs, the set of graphs I was able to do for these revisions.
Okay, so do you want to go sequentially through the graphs or?
I'm just, listing the graphs I have.
Okay.
I guess the one we will discuss today.
Okay.
So
the first one is when you're varying the request rate.
The request rate.
And here the response time is for 4K requests?
All the experiments are 4K.
Okay. Yeah. And the sequence is random, is it?
The sequence in this case is random. That's right.
There are two curves, means two...
Two curves, one for memorize and one for sampling. So the first one is the... is the rate versus... Average, actually, this is average response time.
Okay.
Average response time in each of the different rates. Mm-hmm. So I double the rate each time.
Mm-hmm.
And the x-axis is last k.
Okay. So is it that you put the device in some state before you do this experiment?
Start from the random state that they have the SST from before.
Okay.
So for now I haven't checked or set the device in any initial state, any of the experiments.
Okay. So that might be one of the questions that we will have to address in our paper, because I think there's been more than one paper that has talked about the importance of state in predicting the performance or of both read as well as write.
Yeah. With different states of the SSD?
For different states of the SSD. So there's this first paper that was the Sigmetrics paper,
mm-hmm.
where they basically argued for putting the device in a specific state, either fragmented or unfragmented. And then the UFLIP paper, which Ariel forwarded, again they show that if the device is in a, and there they actually put it in a very fragmented state, initial state, by doing mm-hmm. random write. It's very different than what the Sigmetrics guys did. They did, they tried to put it in a more, in a better state, by writing sequentially to the entire SSD. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, regardless of what we do and which one we pick, we should have some understanding of the state of the device for each of the experiments before we do the experiment.
Okay.
So that might be something to keep in mind when we do the next round of graphs, the next set of experiments.
I think maybe we can just give the details of each graph, what exactly what we want to have the have it for that graph, and mm-hmm. just like that. I mean, so
yeah.
that to clarify that.
So I think that comment I had was a general comment that applies to all the graphs.
For all the graphs, yeah.
So we have to know the state of the device, and
right.
and it has to be in some unknown state, cannot be unknown state, right? I mean, it has to be a known state, like either fragmented or written sequentially.
Right.
It might be interesting as well to try with both strategies. I mean,
random
sequentially,
and
then
the results of both.
Yeah.
Getting random writes. Yes.
This is
that may be one thing which is new about our paper, right? That we actually look at the state as a first.
Maybe that one is better than the other. I'm not sure, and I didn't quite understand the motivation for this. Well, the motivation for you, Flip, is that you need to have a known state, right? But why random write is better than sequentially writing? They claim somehow that it's more stable than sequentially writing, right? But the rationale is not so clear to me. So experimentation may reveal extra information saying that maybe the random write strategy is better in the long run.
One possible hypothesis that I have is that this UFLIP paper was published in January 2009,
yeah.
Right, which means that it appeared before the Sigmatrix paper. And in the Sigmatrix paper, it's not straightforward how they set the initial state. They do a sequential write, but then followed by that, they do additional sequential write.
Random?
No, additional, so in the Sigmatrix paper.
Right, right.
They do a sequential write for the entire SSD, but then they write sequentially even more to capture the, or to clear the log block information.
To trigger the garbage collection.
Trigger the garbage.
But wasn't the second phase the random write the only in the first gigabyte of the device?
Random write. Okay,
yeah.
But there was some trick to how to set the how to do the sequentiality. And so maybe these guys didn't do the second part. And they ended up with log blocks that had random stuff in them, and therefore, depending on what you wrote before the sequential write, you might have differing performance. And that's why maybe they saw that there's a variance in the performance with the sequentially doing it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you do randomly, then your logs are all messed up as randomly as possible. You don't have that issue.
So your point
is that there are different ways of trying to get to the initial state.
Yeah, different ways in trying to get to a known initial state. I think the Sigmatrix paper had one approach, and these UFLIP guys have a different approach. I don't know which is the better one. It seems like for normal usage, you really don't know what the state of the SSD is. And it's somewhere in between these two extremes, right? It's probably...
Can we design experiments to specific experiment before this?
Yeah,
and
so
this sort of attack,
the design is already available. The Sigmatrix paper specifies their design.
Right, yeah.
To put it in a known state A, and the UFLIP paper has another design to put it in a different known state B. And what Ariel is suggesting, I guess, is to run our experiment after putting the device in both these states. So for each experiment, we have two sets of graphs. One in known state A, and the other starting from known state B.
For experimentation purposes, right? And I mean, in the end, if they turn out to be the same, I mean, which is person one, or we pick the better, I mean, or the one that shows more our, I mean, the salient features that we want to present.
Either that, or that will motivate us to show both, because they are so different to each other that in the state is so important in such experiments.
And anyway, I have to think about that. You know, not just for profiling purposes, we want to see that everything is smooth. And maybe the state of the SSDs are just, in general, fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, you want to capture that to some extent.
Right.
And it can just to show that everything is, you know, null state to some extent. Or at least we need to actually, you know, artificially create some kind of fragile state, fragmented state. Right. So maybe A and B and C, that's, you know, just to show variety and actually talk about different kind of possibilities.
Yeah, that makes sense. So anyway, so that's just a high level comment, right? And which applies to all the experiments that you might do in the future to have the device in a state that in short, the message is that the experiments that we do have to be reproducible by others independently, right? Otherwise, the experiments do not have any real value. So to be reproducible, we have to make sure that people can recreate the initial state and then do the experiment to reproduce the findings.
The other question I have on figure one, so first of all, we only have two devices right now, right?
We have three.
Yeah.
But I haven't done not much experimentation with the third one.
Oh, okay. And also on the lower one, which is the
memory.
And the curve only starts to rise, and we don't know whether that's a glitch or it's just one data point. And you probably want to, you know, if you want to show that, you probably have to extend that this folder to the right to see what, you know. Obviously, the first one that you can see very clearly. I mean, there is a saturation point, right? And as well as, you know, 4 requests per second, they get saturated. And but we don't see that on the second
makes
one.
Sense. Yeah.
Seems to me that at least we need to figure that out. Mm-hmm. And when it's saturated, that means the service rate and the request rate are more or less the same. That's how it actually gets saturated. I understand, right? So, whether that makes sense.
Yeah.
Response time always kept at 10 milliseconds. No matter how many requests per second. What does that mean? What is the response time? I mean, how response time per request?
Average response time per request.
So tell me why there's a saturation. I mean, why the curve flattened out? Why it's like that? And it's not really increasing, right? So it's and always saturated.
Because
it's not increasing.
This is C to C, which means that this doesn't account for the scale requeue.
So it doesn't account for what?
For the scale requeue. So the thing is that there is a moment that you send so many requests to the device, one after the other, right? That it cannot serve more than this rate. It doesn't matter how many you have in the queue.
That's exactly, yes. Yeah. Yeah, good point. So 10 milliseconds. So this is actually can give you quantitatively 10 milliseconds. 10 milliseconds.
Which now that I
the service rate, right? Pretty much.
Okay.
That is the worst case service rate that you can get.
Exactly.
You can see that you get response times which are smaller if you send out fewer requests per second.
And the reason being, I mean, I'm looking at this as a queue or something like that, right? So it's basically a request coming in one side of the queue. You have service and extra vacate the queue. And no matter how fast your arrival rate, your response time, it doesn't make sense to me. The response time should shoot up to infinity. I mean, that's, you know, if you have a fixed service rate.
Yeah, but the response time is not measured from the time of entry or dispatch to the time of completion. It's just measured from the time of dispatch to the device. So most of the requests spend a lot of time in the scheduler queue, which time is being ignored in these calculations.
Exactly.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So I'm guessing the increase of the response time is just it's a consequence of the internal operations of the device.
It's pushed to the wall, right? So basically,
exactly. You
don't really have any room for just write and forget and come back.
Exactly.
And you have to conduct the
infinite
state operation in meantime, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's a lot faster because you just drop it and come back.
Right.
And I guess it's also because of the write buffer thing. For the memory write, we know it has a larger write buffer.
Mm-hmm.
And then it needs like at least 512 requests per second to separate this buffer and start doing the actual write to the medium.
Yeah.
And the other one, it seems that to be 4 writes per second, then you deplete that buffer and you have to pay this. Of the actual write operation.
How do you conduct the experiment? I mean, you increment, you double the size, the request rate,
mm-hmm.
and every some time.
I send 5,000 requests for each point.
So if the request rate is 64, then you will run for 100 seconds, approximately. If the request rate is 512,
exactly.
You run for 10 seconds.
Exactly.
Because your experiment is limited by the number of requests that you dispatch.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, here once again, I mean, this brings up the initial state.
Mm-hmm.
So if the initial state is fragmented, do we get the same curve or not? And if the initial state is clean, do we get the same curve? I mean, by fragmented and clean, what we really mean is how does the state of the log blocks look like.
Mm-hmm.
The log blocks are clean, then perhaps we can better absorb the new writes. If the log blocks are fragmented, maybe they cannot absorb the new writes as well. Now, the second thing is, so that's one question, which is the initial state and its influence on this graph. The second is the steady state performance. So, with 5,000 requests, maybe you're seeing only the initial part of the performance. And in steady state, maybe things get worse. Maybe if you dispatch 50,000 requests, then from 20,000 requests onwards, the performance is completely different than the initial 20,000.
Well,
would that be possible?
One experiment I have is that, and actually, hold on to put that here, is to write sequentially because that it seems like that has been always an issue, right? If the steady-state performance is the same or not. So one experiment that I did, and I think I mentioned probably some meeting is that I wrote at least sequentially. I don't know what about
mm-hmm.
what is about random. I wrote sequentially the whole device,
mm-hmm.
Which made up probably a couple of hundreds of thousand requests. And the response time was always the same as in the memory. I'm talking about the memory. Mm-hmm. Was always the same as the first order. Was always the same after the request 1,000. Right. So in the case of a random, I would think it's also the same. Also, I don't remember any experiment that I have done to also try that.
So it's just a comment. I think that's something we have to keep in mind when we interpret these numbers. Is that the steady state numbers may actually be different.
Yeah, well, I choose 5,000 because I thought was a reasonable number in terms of steady state performance.
But if you think about it, 5,000 is just 20 megabytes at 4K.
That's true.
Which might not even be 2 or 3 log blocks, or I don't know how big log blocks are.
Yeah,
and
but that will also depend on how how the SSD works, because what I have seen in Samsung is that after you have probably 1,000 requests, the response goes up and it doesn't come down for a while. Right? I mean, it occasionally goes down, but it stays up almost all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess just right. a little inspection. Of the numbers and see if there is a dichotomy.
You don't have to do it for all the numbers.
No.
So you can just pick one point here. Let's say 256 requests per second and run it for a longer period of time.
Well, I guess I can do a more general experiment that is the same random request, but I don't know, 200,000 requests or something like that, just to make sure that the space is not affected by that.
Yeah, it has to be a substantial fraction of the SSD space that you write, percentage-wise. So, I think SSDs can be over provisioned by even 10% or 20%, we don't know. Right. So I think your experiment should probably target writing substantially enough data that you are guaranteed to avoid a log block or any temporary effect that are caused because of the log block.
Also, to really get the numbers, the other way is to look at, I'm not sure whether this is appropriate to look at it, is the variations. Do we have variation numbers or the max and mean and variations? I think once we get these numbers, we got a pretty good handle on whether the state that actually reached, or the experiment reached.
You mean the variation?
Variation and mean and mass.
For instance, you could do 95th percentile of the response times for each point. Right? You could do something like that. Or alternatively, you could just do CDS for all the request rates, if that is easier.
CDS request rate.
So for each request rate, you have a line, which is the CDS for that request rate. It should have been the average.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, if you can get that, that's definitely going to be very helpful.
Yeah. Because I see that he has CDS.
How can you draw that?
He has some in the feature graph.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Yeah. I mean, draw it like, look at both this train and the CDF at the same time. Is there a possibility? I know some graph is showing 75 percentile.
Yeah, 9,
25 percentile or 90 percentile, so we have several ways.
So you could do that. I mean, 95th percentile, you could, for instance, have a range around any point that captures the 9th percentile of the points, and then that would tell us about the variations as well. The CDF, I can see that you might just have too many lines in this graph, especially if you want to capture both Memorite and Samsung on the same chart or a third device. Maybe you want to separate out Memorite and Samsung on two different charts, so that might become easier.
Right. So Memorite is a better SSD than I can see.
Yeah.
And what's the third one? The third one is
SanDisk.
SanDisk is compared to these two.
It's really, really bad.
It's really
bad. Okay. What is SanDisk?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So even worse.
that's why I don't want to try SanDisk much. We have a good set of experiments, like definitive experiments, because it takes a long time.
That's smart. That's very smart.
Yeah. So you probably don't want to. Yeah.
I think that's
you don't want to break.
Because you spend a lot of time with each experiment. I mean, so to summarize, it seems like from this graph, if we take it as it is, without worrying about the initial state and assume that all those things are considered, then what this graph is telling us is that there is a certain maximum rate at which the SSD can serve random write requests.
And
you cannot get more than that. So if you convert that into a throughput number, what we get is 10 millisecond 4K response time, right? So we have 100 4K requests per second.
What's that 4K?
400 kilobytes per second is throughput.
A request size, 4K, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And does that have to be that, or can we change that, or is it going to change the scenario?
I mean,
if we say we use 64K.
Yeah, we can change that.
The shape of the curve is going to change. I mean, the absolute value is going to change, or is it more sequential or whatever that actually costs it a little bit better?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little better, I guess.
So 4K is the logical size, is that right? So like page write.
Right.
The response time curve will probably look very similar, but the bandwidth will be quite different.
Yes.
That's because of the
Yeah, actually the curve could blow up because now you have bigger requests. Right.
Right, yeah.
So
Yeah, that's fine. I'm just a little bit. Okay.
Okay.
We got all the CDF.
Figure 2, okay. Figure 2 is a CDF of the Samsung device for all the rates,
right?
So I actually...
Oh, you have that. Yeah,
yeah.
So you have that. I just been looking at
it. So, you know, one thing is that I saw the figure and seems the lines seems confusing, so I didn't pay much attention to that. I guess, for instance, the one...
One request per second. One request per second. One request per second. So absolutely,
it's going to be 0.2. So one request per second gives you a response time of 200 microseconds.
That's very fast. So that's just the line speed, right? The line speed, basically, you write, you find it, you put in the cache, you come back, right? So that's the line speed of the I/O speed, right? And if you look at the two, which actually beat one.
Yeah.
and suddenly, is that because of the that you are sending two requests back to back, and actually you got?
I think what's happening is that the two requests per second, because you're sending it continuously, the write buffer gets filled up, and it's the cleaning mechanism, the garbage collection gets triggered after a few requests, and then the garbage collection is very inefficient. So you have to wait for the garbage collector to...
No, what I meant is, why is 100?
You have
a better
than...
Why is it better than 200?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that.
Is it because that 2 is faster than 1? Just lump them together. Or a prefetching? That another prefetching. That's
buffering. Write buffering.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, this has to be write buffering. And, so how many requests did you issue at one request per second? 5,000?
Yeah, one of them is 5,000.
So it seems like consistently for one request per second you get exactly the same number.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And 2 requests per second is somewhat different.
That sure seems to be computing that messed up the interpretation. But the other thing seems to be all right. I mean, that's very much like staircase.
Somehow, I feel that this could also be related to the initial state of the SSD.
Right. Because it's run and write, and sometimes you keep, I mean, you get good response times, the other ones are larger.
How do you get good response times?
I mean, good in terms of low latency, right? Like this, 100 milliseconds.
Microseconds.
Microseconds.
How do you get that? I don't
well, that's the unanswered question yet.
Okay.
But, I mean, this the curve for 2 requests per second, it's not constant, right? It starts with 100 microseconds and it goes up to more than 20 or 30 milliseconds.
The interesting thing is that the more than 20% of the requests at 2 requests per second have a response time of 100 microseconds.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's the interesting part. And none of the requests at 1 request per second have lower than 200 microseconds.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting, to say the least. I mean, one explanation could just be that in the experiment that you did with 100 microseconds, the write buffer was completely filled up and there was no space in the write buffer, so that all the requests had to wait for the write buffer to be evicted, emptied, before you can respond for the case of 1 request per second. And in the case of 2 requests per second, the state of the device at the beginning of the experiment was that the write buffer was empty. And then the first, you know, the initial request had very low latency. This is probably can be confirmed by looking at the traces, which requests were the ones that had 100 microseconds. And then the subsequent requests had to pay the price of evicting from the write buffer first before the response. Now, we see approximately 25% of the requests. So 25% of 5,000, right, which is at least 1,000 requests. 1,000 requests times 4K is 4 megabytes. Right, so the question is, does this Samsung have a 4 megabyte write buffer on?
The total number of requests is 5,000 or 500?
5,000. For each write.
For each write.
Could also be that the write buffer is actually smaller, but for some reason the two requests per second, the write buffer is being evicted right away, or it's evicted more proactively than the one request per second, so that future request can actually be buffered. So in some sense, I think this might highlight the importance of the state of the SSD, initial state of the SSD being the same across all these experiments, and maybe that will eliminate some of these anomalies.
Yeah, but then ideally, for each of these lines, we have to start from the initial state.
That's true. So
how long does it take to get to the initial state?
Yeah, that's a problem. I remember that for overwriting the whole SSD, just overwriting sequentially is half an hour.
Can you do a region? Is that the entire SSD? Is that okay to just get a region? One of the regions is being sort of cleaned.
That is a thought, and then the point would be that you do your
just.
Yeah,
in that part.
In that region alone. That might be an approach that's worth investigating. So we could try something like that and contrast it against writing the entire device sequentially for just one point and see how much difference there is. If there is no big difference, then maybe we can use the same approach for all getting all the other points.
So the idea is to compare initial state of one of
so the idea is to
initial state is affecting the
so the idea is to compare initial state where only a fraction of the SSD is in a known state, and the workload is directed just to that fraction of the SSD.
Okay.
Against an experiment where the entire SSD is in a known state and the workload is directed to the entire SSD. And see if the results are similar, or at least the trends are similar. And if the trends are similar, then maybe we can do that.
Also, 5,000 requests. Do you think it's large enough?
Yeah. So we did have that discussion about the steady state, right?
Yeah.
Steady state may take longer. We don't know that yet.
I think it's worthwhile to keep that in mind because.
Yeah. In each case, I think doing some pilot, instead of having to do that completely, do that some pilot which will reduce the duration of the experiment, but still give us reproducible results and results that reflect the trends that we would have had if we had done over the entire device. I think those ideas can certainly be of a lot of help in speeding up our experimentation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's something that people, the Sigmatrix guys, do. They don't experiment in the whole SSD, but rather they do, I think, the first couple of gigabytes,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Instead of doing 2 gigabytes, I think you want to choose a number that is larger fraction of the total state. So for instance, in a 64 gigabyte SSD, maybe 2 gigabytes is not a good choice. Maybe you have to do something larger than that.
Yeah, I think they do something like 10 gigabytes
mm-hmm.
or so in 20 years.
And the thing is that I think that your point is still true in the sense that if you have a random of the entire disk or a random only, you know, sort of focus on a particular region, and that number is not necessarily going to be the same, right?
Not necessarily the same, but if they are similar in trend, maybe it's still valuable. Maybe
you can extract that, somehow can extract that into large cases. Because you might actually overload the striking the internal parallelism, whatever it is, that actually the exclusive mechanism that actually allow you to expand higher. Maybe random through the entire disk is actually faster than
the
particular region.
So the strategy for initializing the SSD would be just sequential writes and nothing else, or should we also combine with this random write workload?
Yeah, so like you said, I think it is certainly worth looking at two different states, initial states of the device, as being states that are known states. And just to make our observations more rich, because some observations may only be true if the initial state is clean, and which may not be true all the time in reality. In reality, you don't always have a clean initial state at any point during your workflow. That's not true. So on the other hand, maybe a completely fragmented SSD is not also realistic, right? So I think in reality you have a state which is somewhere in between, and then it's hard for you to show experiments for each of those intermediary states, right? So, but if we show the extremes, maybe we get a good idea as to what the intermediary performance might look like. Might be somewhere in between these extremes. And I think that is something that people have not explored yet. For instance, the Sigmatrix guys do that to some extent with the last experiment with the fragmented SSD, read and write, but they don't do that in detail. And I guess one of the reasons is that you can only fit so much content in one paper. So this is a direction that we could potentially explore to make our work contribution novel. Or now say, okay, we explore two different states of the SSD and characterize performance starting from these states.
Which in the one of the last paragraphs, I think, of the Newsweek paper, they mentioned that they're going to tackle that as a future work.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a deeper understanding of the state of the device.
Yeah.
Probably, I mean, starting with different states and different strategies, which, I mean, it's not clear which one is going to be better or is going to have more stable behavior.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, I mean, what do we see? I mean, there's some interesting trends here. Like, for instance, there's the step behavior, and some of the lines are very synchronized in when they have their steps. So that is quite interesting. We don't know what these different things are. So it seems that there are some distinct levels of response times. So for instance, if we take 500 and actually 1 and 512 are exactly
the
same line.
Yeah, I don't know why. Probably GNU plots run out of line.
So if you look at 512, for instance, I think there are some typical response times, right? There is one response time which is, maybe 2 milliseconds, another response time which is 4 milliseconds, then another response time which is 12 milliseconds. And so there are some typical response times that are dominant.
Yeah, there are something like actually almost 10 times difference. I mean, the bigger gap, I mean, the measure is almost 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least more than 5 times difference.
I guess you could possibly associate or have some hypothesis as to what these response times might mean. Right? So for instance, maybe the first response time is associated with being in the right buffer and waiting for some specific operation, which is writing to a locked block, and then waiting for a certain block erase operation. So things of that kind, you could speculate that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very hard to actually prove anything.
It's very hard to do that. Yeah.
Very hard to prove anything.
But the trend, and the obviously from what? Look at this file. From 4 requests beyond, right? 416, 364, 256, and I mean their average should be all 10 milliseconds.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But look at the CDF. They're totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the time spent is not necessarily spent on the same location, at the same place. Right? And even though the average is the same.
So the median is lower than 10 is what you're saying. The median value.
Well, let's throw out 1, 2, 4, right? So that basically the first, or just 1 and 2. Okay, let's throw them out.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two types of curves. So there is the middle one, which is somehow in between,
mm-hmm.
right? And but these are, all these curves have a mean of
10 milliseconds.
10 milliseconds.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure about the median, though.
The median is where you have value
the middle one,
of 50%.
50%
out. Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, 50% out is going to be a different for sure. I mean, you draw the line, you know where that is, right?
And in most cases, in fact, it seems like in all cases, the median is lower than the mean.
True.
Yeah.
If you draw the line, horizontal line, right, like this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's where the 50 percentile
median
is always smaller than 10.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So which means that there are some points which are really outliers, very high values that skew the average.
That's true.
So in some sense, the average does not tell us the majority case performance.
So is it coincidence that we have 10? Or is it some kind of a...
The question is, what would happen if you do larger number of trials than 5,000?
That's true.
Yeah. Where would you see more of the requests lie?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's not clear to me. Maybe it will be exactly the same from a CDF point of view.
Or talking about steady state.
Or steady state.
Is it in the beginning or is it in the sort of the later half? You know, that's always pushing it longer and larger and larger. So if you run, you know, instead of 5,000, you run 50,000, is that actually always extra skew larger? Right.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, then obviously 10 milliseconds is underestimated the worst case scenario, right?
That's true. So I'm thinking, what sort of metric can we use? Can we use a median value instead? Maybe a better reflection, because a median value might have a graph that looks much different than this guy, right?
Oh, the only difference. Is they're going to be a jump.
It's probably going to be more smooth like this, right?
No. Remember all these curves are actually all together, right? So basically they have two
steps.
Left.
So you have something like this and then...
And then somehow going up, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, so that's the median value. Okay. But... The median might actually, it conveys a different piece of information than the mean.
obviously, we let's not think about how we draw the graph at this point. I think it's more of, you know, try to scoop up what exactly it means here. Maybe we should just, you know, make it a little bit longer run.
Yeah.
Make it more requests.
Mm-hmm.
And pay attention to whether the first half of the request and the second half of the request, they're suffering. You know, you can run two averages.
Yeah.
And just make sure that they are.
That's a good point, yeah. So to see if we reach steady state or not.
We are reaching steady state or not.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe we should move on to the next guy, the Memorite.
I think it's possible that because of smaller requests, the buffer is not easily filled up or something that, you know, if you run more, maybe this line is getting closer and closer to that line. And just because of this transient effect, I mean, just speculation at this point. Sorry, yeah.
That's a thought. So we have, so the CDF actually shows you that 512 has a distinct
shape, yeah, staircase.
So there is a trend that's going on here. So from 512 to 1024.
Yeah, look at this. This particular segment is gradually increasing. I'm not sure how many points there because we're not drawing the number of points. But
no, we know the number of points because it's 90%.
Oh yeah, 5,000. You're right. 5% about there, 5-7%.
Yeah, of 5,000 points.
Right.
And then it seems like.
But we don't know whether the point is here or points is just there, right?
Yeah. No, the points are all in this range. Most
right
of the
in
points,
this range, we just don't know the distribution of this range. It could be just going here and then, you know, shifting all the way the other.
No, it's not because it's a CDF, right? So we have one point for each of these. Otherwise, it will not increase. Otherwise,
it will
just go
flat.
Up or
yeah.
keep flat. So yeah. if it's increasing, that means that we have representation.
Yeah. Of course,
almost
yeah, yeah.
Anything.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah. What I'm thinking.
And in fact, for 1024, you see that there is a sort of very good distribution over this entire range, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
that's common with this. So to some extent.
And it would be a good guess to say that if we go to 2048, it would be more like this, right? Going further this way.
Well, depending on what's the worst case, right?
Yeah, maybe it will be like this, right? Or something like this. Because both these points are intersecting here. That's the 512 and the 1024 are intersecting. And maybe one possibility is that the 2048 also intersects at that point. So the worst case response time is bounded regardless of the frequency.
The difference between these two experiments is because this is 512
mm-hmm.
and this is 1024, right? So there are a lot going on in this gap.
Yeah.
Right?
So there might be, so for 2048, you might have a graph that looks like this, or it looks even worse like this.
That's true.
So
yeah,
it's certainly interesting to go higher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're thinking that it's also probably worth to explore between 512 and 1024, right? Because it's a big gap here.
Yeah, so
mm-hmm.
it could be,
good
yeah.
point.
Yeah.
They might have some interesting behavior. But I don't think that's important as important as having 2048 so we actually see the trend. And then you can hypothesize that the points between 512 and 1024 are going to be distributed based on the distribution of the remaining ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is a very good experiment. I mean, in the end, we could just show this. I mean, given that we don't have all these kind of effects,
mm-hmm.
and show this, it actually can mean something. You know, for this scare case, just as you said, this could be interpreted by
some kind of activity that's going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that actually delayed it further on.
Which is only the guys who manufacture these devices
would be able to know, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And same deal, like what Louis suggested, that I probably want to fit in so that we can see what are the other variations of the stairs
mm-hmm.
that we could actually observe from this. Maybe not. Maybe just worthwhile at least to take a look.
Okay, so I think we have to move faster because we're still on the first one.
Yeah. That way the first page.
Probably 1 hour. One page per hour. So I think the next most interesting is probably section 7, which is random writes, random and sequential writes, the read, still in hold. Okay, so for this, I have figures 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Okay, so you don't have figures for the other things. You just directly jump in here. All
Because for those, I have to receive certain. Okay, so the first parameter is sequential, the CDF of sequential and random write.
And there is no waiting time between the requests.
There is no waiting time, one or the other. Yeah. Back to work.
The sequential and the random, meaning what? It's the you fix the chunk size, right? The block size, the request size.
The request size 4K. 4K
okay.
for all experiments is 4K.
Okay. And you either do it sequentially, that's what sequential means,
mm-hmm.
or randomly, it's random over the entire
SSD.
Disk range.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So the first two lines are the memory.
Yeah, you know what? The Samsung, the random line of the Samsung looks exactly the same as the CDF of figure 2, right? Or really similar.
Okay. The one in between.
The one in between, yeah.
Which one?
This one? This one.
This is,
looks like the 128 requests per second.
Tell me these curves again. I can't really see the. This is the far right one. Is the Samsung random?
These two are sequential.
Oh, this one is sequential. Okay.
These two are random. So probably
okay.
There you can.
And then
this is memory.
This is gonna be
Samsung.
Right. Sequential, so this is a sequential, this is SAM disk. This is sequential, it's memory. Okay.
Now, the other thing is that the curve for random writes of the memory look pretty much the same as the figure 3 for 1024 requests per second.
And the previous experiment is all random, right?
Yeah.
So that's why they are the same, right?
Because
they are the same experiment, right?
Right. So the difference, one difference in this case is 10,000
requests. 10,000
requests. Mm-hmm. Instead of
5,000. Okay. And we also look at different requests per second. So this is a request per second. So as long as...
No.
So this is also fixed the number of requests per second, but this is actually just... You just keep
synchronous.
Blasting.
What's that?
This one is synchronous, right?
The sequential is synchronous, back to back. But yeah, because I do synchronous is because I want to avoid merging the operating system.
Yeah.
So
back to back. Do you have numbers about the number of requests? Because you can actually count, right?
Yeah, I have the numbers of requests. I think for the sequential case was 10,000.
No, not total number of requests.
Okay.
Request per second. Because you do back to back, right? That basically means that how fast that disk can absorb your request.
Right.
At the fastest rate, right? So as soon as I'm ready, you give me another one. So anything beyond that number is meaningless, almost.
Okay.
Right.
I don't think I have that number, but I guess I can calculate it.
Right, yeah, you can calculate, right?
Yeah.
Is the C2D zero?
The C2D, I don't know the C2D. I mean, I have that number. I can calculate that number with beta stats, but it's pretty close to zero.
If it's pretty close to zero, then you have the frequency with this graph itself, right? Because you know that they are back-to-back issued, and you know the response time. So
that's
you
true.
Can
That's true. Actually, if we use that, so what does that mean? If I'm done with the request, let's say next one. You give me the next one, say zero time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that means that that's the fastest I can
dispatch.
Yeah. If you give me more, it's going to be queued up. So all the numbers here doesn't mean anything if the number is beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so this is actually the number in terms of the true number that is actually push the device right on the wall, basically. Right.
And
so I guess then a good number to report is the C2D for each of these sensors.
So we know what is the frequency. If you issue more than the then your latencies are going to get worse.
But you are not counting that, right?
We are counting that in this figure. So this is figure 2.
Oh, okay.
Right.
I thought you are not counting it. You said that's the time you issue it, the time you respond, right?
For
there is no queuing time.
There is no queuing time, but in this case, we are not issuing synchronously, right? You're issuing asynchronously.
That's one thing I don't know. I probably may be issuing synchronously.
But if you're doing synchronously, then the request rate is meaningless. Because the request rate is governed by the response time. So if the response time is slow, then you cannot maintain a certain request rate.
I see.
It has to be, look at the flatten out. So obviously that means that you only, basically this is the service time, right? Not the queuing time. The queuing time is no, because the queuing time is more requests coming in, the more you queue, the time should increase. This is not increasing.
But if you look at the CDF,
right?
That's the average, right?
Right.
But if you look at the CDF, you can see that the numbers actually change, right? The response times change. So the higher...
But if the C2D is sufficiently small, then it doesn't matter if it's synchronous or not, right?
It matters because... So it depends on what is the consequence of your statement, but it seems like if you claiming that you issue requests at 1024 per second,
okay,
is not supported by the CDF of the request time latency, right? Because if your latency average is 10 milliseconds, then only 100 requests per second are being serviced. So 1024 requests per second of dispatch is meaningless. The device is getting only 100 requests per second.
Yeah, but that would happen even if you're sending an asynchronous request.
even if you're sending asynchronous or synchronous. So if what I'm saying is that this, it's not possible that you issue synchronous requests at 1024 per second because the device does not allow you to. Because if you wait for the response to come before you issue the next request,
okay,
you cannot do 1024 per second.
Right, but the point is that I think the point is that you try to do it to that rate. If you cannot, then
you
don't have an option, right?
You queue up, right?
Exactly, or you queue.
No, you don't even queue in this case if you're doing synchronously.
But you can think of the benchmark
as issuing in batches.
It's not sending in batches, but you can think of the benchmark as if the request is queue waiting for the previous one to finish, right?
All I'm saying is that this experiment cannot be synchronous because here you claim that you issue requests at 1024 per second synchronously. It is not
right.
Supported by the latencies of the device.
Explain to me what that synchronous means.
Synchronous means that you send the next request only after you get the response of the previous request.
It can be.
I don't see the difference between the synchronous and asynchronous.
With the asynchronous, you can always dispatch the request whenever you want to without caring about the completion of the previous request.
Mm-hmm.
So you can maintain any request rate.
Okay.
The completion rate is different, of course. But the request rate can be arbitrary and can be 1024 per second.
Right. But I guess my point is that the results would be the same.
It's
almost impossible to fit that number of requests within that period of time.
That's your
point.
So you're looking at a line which is 100 per second of synchronous requests.
Mm-hmm.
Which may actually have a different line on this than 1024 requests per second of asynchronous.
Okay.
So 1024 requests per second of asynchronous and attempted 1024 requests per second of synchronous will be completely different lines. Because the attempted 1024 requests per second of synchronous will convert into 100 requests per second of asynchronous. You see how that would be?
But the thing is that you have, if the device is not able to serve more than 100 requests per second, it doesn't matter where you keep your queue of requests.
But you see that there is a difference in the lines at 100 and 1024. There are two completely different areas.
What do you mean?
So here what I'm saying is that if you do the synchronous, your 1024, attempt 1024 will be 100 requests per second. It will be equivalent to 100 requests per second asynchronous.
I see what you mean.
And those lines are different.
They seem to be different. In any case, I don't remember if I have asynchronous or synchronous, but
my guess is that it's asynchronous.
So
taking that argument, so if I'm doing 2048 or, whatever, even larger, 8,000. The lines should be just this.
Exactly.
Because it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how many...
It seems like it is mattering, actually, for some reason. I don't know what.
Mm-hmm.
It could be because the C to D is changing or somehow you have so many requests in the queue that the OS latencies creep into your D2C measurement. And those could be...
Who's doing the queue? Is that you doing the queue or is it the device?
If it's asynchronous, it's doing the device.
So you're going to flood the OS with a lot more requests than it can consume.
Yeah.
And it's going to build over time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this for this particular experiment, that's fine because the total number of requests are only 5,000. So you can hold 5,000. But later on...
Mm-hmm.
If you give 5 million requests, then it's gonna overflow the buffer, right? To some extent, the queue.
So what will happen in that case is that you cannot generate so many requests because creating a request requires you to allocate memory, and the memory allocations will start failing.
Right. Yeah.
Which means that the your benchmark will automatically draw to.
So carry on the argument that I'm thinking is it makes no sense to do the first experiment with the number of requests larger than what actually I'm showing here, because you know, that's only the OS overhead is actually exploiting, not the disk, you know, characteristics anyway, right?
Yeah.
So this is the right experiment. So to do back to back.
Yeah.
This is the right experiment. Assuming the C2P, you know, making close to zero, it can be more.
Yeah.
Like that, right?
But I mean, even the higher values of dispatch asynchronously is realistic, because you have no control on the rate at which applications can dispatch our requests.
But
and
they
can be 10-24 requests per second.
You
and,
could.
And in such a case, your latencies are
you can't do latency. You don't have a stable system. There is no steady state in that case. Whatever the size of the buffer, you're going to explode the buffer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're going to overflow the buffer.
Yeah.
Right? So it just depends on how much operating systems, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, give you the memory, the
mm-hmm.
size of the memory you can consume, right? So beyond that point, it's not much of the point of experimentation. It's probably just a transient that you can explore.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, it's just not necessarily.
Yeah.
Right. So anything I think it should be you know below this. So. You know, if you got anything, this means 100 milliseconds per response time. So that's where.
100 milliseconds? Yeah.
So you got 10 requests at most?
That's on the high side. I mean, then you have.
On the.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's the.
That those are the outliers.
The outliers. And then the most that you can get 1 millisecond. So, you know. Less than 1,000. Right?
Yeah.
So 10 to 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's
Now, I guess one way to look at this graph is to. Yeah, I do understand your point about steady state versus non-steady state. Maybe we're looking at non-steady state information at these higher request rates.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be a good thing to see. Okay, what happens if we increase the number of requests from 5,000 to something higher, and then look at the CDF again. I mean, does the new CDF look the same as the old CDF?
Yeah.
And if it's different, in which cases it's different? My guess is that it would probably be different for the higher numbers in the non-steady state,
mm-hmm.
with the higher requests per second. And then it would, what that would mean is essentially what Jason is saying, that these higher lines are does not have any real meaning, because these are lines that change because it's not in steady state, right? But I do agree with that, and we can confirm that by running a longer experiment for these higher numbers.
I would guess, because you know, again, running a longer experiment will take a lot of time, right? So I guess it would be enough just to take, and I think Ray said that it's earlier that. We can take a pilot experiment, like
yeah.
a random write, and have, you know, issue plenty of requests and see if that change.
No, but the rate experiment is something unique. So what you could do, for instance, take 10-24 per second, just do that experiment for a longer period of time. You don't have to do all of them. And maybe you can do 64 per second. Do it for a longer period of time. If you see that the 64 per second CDF remains the same and the 1024 actually changes, then we can know for sure that there is a steady state argument that is missing from this graph.
Or you can do the memorite. This is a faster one, right? The
yeah.
The memorite. Look at this curve. It's the same as memorite, right? So the
mm-hmm.
two curves.
Right.
And that means that, you know, 1024 is already reaching.
The yeah. limit.
The limit.
Yeah.
So it's probably what you draw there like this is never going to happen. Unless there are some other effects that I'm going to take into consideration, just what you just said there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably, you know, we can just do
you know, 2,000 or 4,000 or something to see whether the curve shifts. If it doesn't shift, you know, this just means that this is a more meaningful experiment than this one. Even mm-hmm. even though it gives the impression that you're doing synchronous, but in the end it's not. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, impression of doing asynchronous, but in the end you are doing synchronous.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so then you have some timelines here.
Yeah. Yeah, for the same experiment, two timelines, memorize for sequential, at random, transform sequential back.
What happened here?
Sorry. I don't know.
This is sequential.
That's sequential.
And
it yeah.
happened to be around 1,000.
And also initially, right?
And initially.
And also initially, right?
Yeah, I forgot. I don't know why it stopped here. I mean, I have the numbers for more than 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be interesting to see if this line happened again in 2044.
48. Yeah. So yeah, draw that longer one to see if there is a trend.
But I think
and then memorize sequential timeline, again you can draw a longer one. And same for random as well. The random at least there is some initial warm-up phase and then you see bad performance.
Mm-hmm. This is actually being observed elsewhere, right? So that's one of those papers. Samsung random. This is...
Oh!
Hello? Okay. Right. Right, right. Okay, sure, yeah. I'm busy in meetings at least for the next couple of hours. Mm, 2 hours. Yeah. All right. Okay, bye. So, I think the random experiments maybe will tell us something.
Mm-hmm.
If we know for sure that the trends are maintained across the longer experiments. So here again you have 5,000 points or 10,000 points?
I guess I have more. Probably in this case I have 10,000 for... I don't remember well because... No, actually I have for the whole SSD. I have the same thing. Oh, this is random. So this is different. No, I'm talking about sequential. For random... for random I have probably 10,000 or 100,000.
Yeah.
So obviously there is a warm-up phase, right?
Yeah, there at least for the Samsung, there is a warm-up phase, which means that if you use the same data to plot the CDF, it's not steady state.
I use the same data. Yeah. Yeah.
So then it is not steady state CDF, because you also include this initial warm-up phase in the CDF.
Yeah.
Correct?
Right.
So that's the Samsung random. Samsung random is this guy. So there is this initial warm-up phase that's shown in the CDF, which will disappear when you you do a longer experiment.
Not necessarily. Well, you still have these smaller ones actually later on.
Hmm, that's true.
Yeah, it's probably not going to show up in the CDF. It's just a little bit skewed.
Yeah. So probably one thing I can do and see the difference in the CDF is to start your CDF from request 1000, right?
Well, one thing you need to do is to do it longer, because we don't know that there might be other levels of latencies that show up later on.
Yeah, the other thing is that I don't know how long this.
You have 10,000?
Probably, I already have. That's what I think, but probably have even longer than that.
Yeah, why don't we just plot them all at least to take a look whether there are.
Yeah, the problem of plotting the 100,000 is that then you miss the detail. I mean, then you cannot see anything. That's the problem. That's why I put only 2,000. Right?
Right, so maybe you can do both. You can look at a more zoom in
sense.
And then zoom
that
out. I think that will help. Because he certainly, the fact that there is a warm-up space is important to show. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't see that in the longer graph,
that
needs to be shown in a
different way.
Okay.
Which is pretty much smeared.
Yeah, there's really no, it doesn't seem like there is any pattern except for the fact that there is a more dense distribution of the response times at lower latencies.
Which is showing pretty much like 70% or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a lower point. There's something higher.
That's Samsung. You're looking at the memory.
I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. So there are something slower, denser. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's interesting. So, what I meant is that there is, the lower latency should be somehow skewed, but it's not for some reason.
Well, I guess no matter what, I think we just need to see a little bit more out far right.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to make sure that this is the pattern we are looking at, which is the steady state pattern.
So Louis, you looked at the longer graph yourself?
Yeah.
So for the 100,000?
Yeah.
For both Memoride
and they look pretty much
Samsung?
The same. Yeah, there was no more...
No more changes?
No more changes.
Okay.
It's the same, mostly, this range of requests.
Okay, so for 100,000, right?
I think probably, 100,000.
Times
4. No more than that.
Okay, so that's 400 megabytes.
Right.
In some sense, it can be argued that it's still small.
Yeah.
Right.
How large is the disk?
32 gigabytes. Both. Actually, the Memorize 64 gigabytes from Samsung is 32.
Yeah.
Okay, so 116.
It might be that we are still writing to log blocks in all these random experiments.
Could be
that there is no cleaning triggered, which
I think somehow we need to design the experiments so that we have captured the
steady state.
Steady state.
Mm.
And not to run it too long for 2 months or something like that.
Yeah.
Somehow we need to sort of devise something there.
The problem is that for writes to get to steady state, you have to write at least as much as the number of log blocks in the device, in fact more than that, to reach some sort of steady state.
Right.
Or maybe start with some initial...
If you are starting from a clean slate.
If you're starting from a clean slate. On the other hand, if you're starting from a fragmented state, maybe it's not so important. So these are all the things that I guess you will have to think about before running the next set of experiments, so you don't
see this is I'm sorry. So this is like the counter argument. I mean, you can have a clean slate.
Mm.
You have to sort of override the entire log.
Mm.
And after writing, in writing the log, you can always think of this as a warm up, right? It's always the warm up. And you have to discard all the value because you have to reach a steady state, which is a fragmented state, and to start with, right? And to really do the memory, and somehow actually we are not trying to start from a clean slate, but rather to start from an averaged fragmented state to do the measurement.
Mm.
That is the steady state, right?
I see what you mean.
Well, but ensuring that the device is in that state, I think, is hard.
Because it's kind of a random state.
Yeah.
And what we want is to be able to reproduce
the graph. reproduce so that other people can reproduce the results.
Right, yeah. And the one way to do this is to reuse. Once we, you know, we start from a clean and do a particular size request in random. You know, after it's been filled, I mean, we say, you know, 400 megabytes is not going to be enough. Let's say 32 gigabytes, whatever. I mean, large enough so that you can override with everything. And starting from there, we think that this is pretty random. And we can learn together some of the experiments there, rather than, as long as you keep random, right? Not to do this over and over again, because this is, you know, getting this is going to be a long time. So that's what I meant, that devise some kind of a meaningful experiment to save some time. Otherwise, for each data point, we have to run this, I don't know how long does it take to really get the state to that point.
Mm. Yeah. Unfortunately, it seems like we are stuck with running long experiments. I don't really see a way around it.
Why? Well, the thing is that even for small experiments, we have to set the SSE in a non-state, right? It seems like all the non-state, the only way we know to have the SSE in a non-state is with a long, right?
It's not the non-state that actually we're trying to go after. It's the steady state we're trying to get. I think what happened is that, you know, either we say we start from a very clean, so doing the sequential.
I don't agree. I think that I see your point that it is important to put the device in a steady state.
Mm-hmm.
But steady state is going to be very different for each workload.
For each experiment.
For each workload, right? Because what you're trying to go after is to produce results that are usable in practice.
Probable. Mm-hmm. Probable. But what my point here is, let's do two experiments. One experiment is go with a very clean slate.
Mm-hmm.
You start from there and you warm up, right? You do particular experiment, you warm up, and you discard all those, and then you start to measure. So that means that you get to a point where you get actually a pretty fractured, fragmented state, or whatever you think is no dose effect, and you can reproduce the result just by following our procedure.
Mm-hmm.
You get here, and you do the experiment. The other one is to really, quote-unquote, cheat a little bit, in the sense that you could actually say, after these many random writes, the state is actually statistically indistinguishable from a clean state approach following procedure. If we can actually have these two experiments produce the same result, that means we can actually cheat a little bit by just doing it rather than always following. So all we need to do is to in this paper and say, you know, let's actually do side-by-side comparison and have a clean slate approach and have a random approach and to sort of to cure the SSD to a certain level of, you know, a random state. And say, from here, you see all these experiments that generate the same result.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't need to do that, you know, for each experiment. Otherwise, we're going to kill ourselves and probably not going to really. Maybe you're right. Maybe they're never actually going to be the same.
Mm.
If that's
the case. It's kind of tricky. I see the point of trying to save some time and even to try to hurt less the device, because every time you restart and write and listen, you're making it more unreliable perhaps. Mm. But that for some devices it matters. And for others, like earlier in the sigmetric experiments, when they increase the randomness of the workload by choosing or picking LBAs that were farther away from the initial, let's say, 1 GB or 4 GB they focused on, the results were different from the low-end device, I think. Whereas for the high-end, it was pretty much the same. So I guess it has to do with the mapping, has to do with the combination of the write buffer, and many other things in the middle. And somehow we are kind of constrained to start, at least at the beginning, from that clean slate, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see. And later, if I mean, we do this second experiment using a different initialization, I mean, the second is plan B or C, and see if we get to the same results, then we can say, we can save some time now.
That's true. Yeah, so we do both experiments and then they lead to the same results.
Yeah, we do a separate experiment, just, you know, name that as the initialization factor or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we just study that, you know, because there is no right environment for experiment, obviously. I mean, whatever, you, we have a clean one, obviously you need to warm up. That would be, that means the first number of rides need to be discarded. All those measurements need to be discarded because that's not a typical steady state behavior. We'll always see things changing like this and we have to discard those things.
Yeah.
Right?
So if you remember the Sigmetrics paper, right, they actually talk about the difference in performance with starting from a clean state and a fragmented state, and they actually show that there is substantial difference in the performance.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that, if we are to believe that, then it seems like when we take both initial states into account and do experiments, we end up with completely different observations.
True. Yeah, but it depends on where we gonna make the claim about the results, right? If we say this is the results actually coming from fragmented states, these are the results from a completely clean state, non-state. They're gonna be different. They're gonna differ quite a bit. On the other hand, which one is making sense? Both of them make sense. You know, all we need to do is to figure out exactly which, if we are trying to get steady state, the clean state is not gonna make sense because. But it's repeatable, but it's not making sense because you have to do a lot. You have to discard a lot of transient behavior before you can really observe the steady state.
That's true. I mean, I wouldn't agree that it does not make any sense at all because you could, for instance, derive an average case performance by looking at the performance in the starting from the clean state,
right? Yeah.
And the performance when the SSB is very fragmented. And argue that, well, my actual performance is most likely could going to be somewhere in between these things.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there is a meaning for the clean slate experiment, and there is, of course, a worst case meaning for the other experiment. Doesn't tell us exactly what the performance is going to be in reality, but it tells us, in some sense, the boundary.
I agree with that, yeah. So it makes sense to really get performance results for case A and case B, maybe a hybrid of all of them. And I guess the point is how to get case B, which is the fragmented state, faster.
Yeah.
If we can always go from the beginning, populate the entire disk, and until you get to the point where we start to collect measurements, and I don't know how long does it take to really sort of refreshing the entire.
I think there we can use the idea that you propose, which is maybe write to fraction of the SSD instead of writing to the entire SSD, the speed of the time, and maybe it'll still be okay. For that, we'll have to pilot an experiment where we look at the trends from doing an experiment on the entire SSD versus doing the same experiment on a fraction of the SSD.
For better even, it's a derival procedure that just do random write, and that's, you know, sort of, we gotta see what the difference that it makes. So if we can discover a procedure where they say you write, you know, 5,000 requests and probably a lot more than that, and just do random, and then you derive at the state, which is statistically indistinguishable from getting to a clean state and do this random write to that. So basically, you use those number of random writes to sort of warm up the cache or something like that, right? But if you do that and you derive a you know, that will save us all the costly
sequential
procedure to this. Sequential
write
of the entire disk.
Yeah.
Right.
That certainly helps for the sequential write, but for the case of the completely fragmented random write, that doesn't work. But on the other hand, what we could do is reduce the part of the SSD
where we
do the randomness so that we don't have to write randomly to the entire SSD, but just a portion,
of it.
And then we do the experiments on the same portion. And if we can show that it leads to the same same performance as writing randomly to the entire.
That has to be extracted.
Yeah.
So, because if you say, I'm going to use 1/4 of the disk, assuming that the other 3/4 of the disk is going to have equally hits of my request.
No, but if you do the benchmark so that you only write to that portion of the request, of the SSD always,
okay,
virtually ignoring the rest of the space on the SSD,
right,
then there will be no request to that other portion.
But what does that mean? I mean, how do you extract the results as if that we are sending requests to the entire disk and randomly? Is that going to be the same? I don't think it's going
to
be the same.
No, we have to pilot that. We have to pilot one experiment where we compare doing an experiment on only part of the SSD versus doing it on the entire SSD and look at the numbers.
Right.
If they look the same, then we can use the approximation. Else we cannot.
Right.
It's the same case that
the other thing that you proposed,
which I just ignore the try to avoid the initial sequential writing by doing this random write, but again we have to make the comparison to be sure that it actually turns out to be the same.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so what is this last figure that you have?
Figure is for experiment of writing the same page again and again for 100,000 times or so. So in that case, there is SanDisk, and how it's on the SanDisk. It turns out that for SanDisk, it's 1 millisecond always.
Mm-hmm.
Almost. While for the other guys, it's 100 microseconds.
Same location. Why are you writing to the same location again? It's going to, you want to see the effect of the cleaning. Is that right?
See the effect of the cleaning, but so, you know, it's a weird experiment because if you write to the same page again and again, probably you will heat the buffer all the time, which I think is what is happening in the memory and the Samsung, right? And that's why you have 100 microseconds always.
Yeah.
So I think that the interesting part of the experiment is probably the SanDisk, where you have 1 millisecond. And I was thinking that doesn't look like a buffer heat, right? It's something else.
Oh yeah,
there's no buffer. No write buffer.
No write buffer.
No write buffer and no logging.
No logging, exactly.
So it probably includes the erase operation each.
Yeah, but then. The problem with that is that I think the erase of a block was 1.5 milliseconds.
For this device, for the SanDisk?
For that device, for the SanDisk. So how come you have 1 millisecond, right? And that's just the erase of the block, but you have more operations like reading the whole block to memory, doing the merge, and write again. Right?
It could depend on how it is doing the mapping. So how... I mean, could it be that your and this is synchronous request, so you have only one outstanding request to the device at any given time?
Yeah.
Okay. There's no device request queue.
No.
Okay. So that means that there is something that's taking 1 millisecond. Most of the time, and sometimes higher than 1 millisecond. A very small fraction, maybe 5% of the time. So, could it be that the erase is more efficient and the blocks are physical, the logical blocks are small? In this case, you don't even have to erase all the logical blocks. You just have to erase the entire logical block. You can just erase physical block,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the request is small enough.
Yeah, but even that will take the whole 1.5 milliseconds. Even if you erase just a block,
a physical block
compared to the to the logical block will say that you want 0.5 milliseconds, because I'm assuming that the logical block you're going to raise all the blocks at the same time.
And the D to C for this is 0 again? That's something we should
see. C to D, I don't remember.
C to D.
C to D. That is something which is important for us to know, because C to D is large, then maybe there is some erase operation happening in the background. So there is always a free block to write into. And so you can read and write and erase later, something like that.
Right. Yeah, that could happen.
Okay.
Okay, so should we go through the
I think pretty quickly because it's rather simple, the read case. So let's walk through. Well, we have a start state where we issue this read request with a certain offset and size. We don't know if this request is sequential or random. So the first decision point is if the device has a read cache. Let's say it does, and then we check if the request is cached. If it is, then we read from the cache, and then we return the data, and that's the end of this path. The alternate path, if we just go back one step to the decision point where R was cached or not, is no, and then we check if the device implements the prefetching feature. Let's say it does, and then we verify if the request is sequential. This requires like extra information, right, as to the previous workload that the device has seen. For example, by looking at the previous reads, if they were sequentially collocated with this current request. If the answer is yes, then I'm just assuming there's a P factor of prefetching that you will increase your size into. Let's say this, I don't know how typical the value for this one is. Let's say, 8K, 16K, something. And then you execute this new request, this modified request in size. If it's not sequential, then you just read the request from the device, which is the same case as when the device does not implement prefetching. You cache this request, because we know before that the path we follow
implements caching,
correct. And then we return the data. Now here is I think that's the second path. And then we just go back one step when the device does not have read cache, and then we read directly from the medium, and then we return the data, and there's no caching involved at all. I'm missing one step here, one path, which is the parallel read operation, which should go in both ways, I think, when you implement caching and when you don't.
Read SSD, right?
Before we read from the SSD, right, we should verify if the request is, let's say, it's sequentially aligned to two planes.
No,
we can make that the case.
I see that as an expansion of read R from SSD.
Yeah, that could be
and
correct.
That would implement this
right,
in each case.
Yeah. I think I agree with that. That would be better.
Because read R from SSD is even more complex than that, right?
It is.
Because it's not just, you have to probably wait for some garbage collection, you have to, that might be going on and things like that. So this is really good. I think it's a good start for the execution path. I think I don't know what you mean by making this expandable, the cache R. So you assume that this is going to be more complex than simply caching. Is that?
Well, not necessarily, because I use this this notation for a function call. I just assume that the cache is a function. It's more like an individual function.
If it's a function, then I see it being more complex. Or I would just look at caching out as an action, right? So if it's a simple action to be performed, but if it's more complex, then I see that it could be something that's
expandable and maybe replaceable with alternate implementations.
Right. Maybe we can consider some, I mean, we all care for response times, right, or for latencies.
Mm-hmm.
So each one of these boxes, well, especially the functions in particular, are going to contribute somehow to the total latency in the response time of the request. So for the cache, it might be that we need to evict some blocks from the cache, and that may consume some time, or we can safely ignore and say...
Caching is just a validate, right, in terms of read, right, no eviction.
Yeah, this is a non-cache request, and, well, we don't know the state of the cache, if it's full or if it has some space to allocate.
So the thing is that to read R from device, you already need space in the RAM. So eviction, if required, should happen before you read R from device, I think.
This read R from device, I intended to imply only the read from the
media,
from the plane, from the medium, into the data register.
Oh,
which is the
into
typical
the data
is time latency. We have as reported by the vendor.
Oh, read R from data register. Okay, from the device.
Yeah, and then there is a bit.
It's no controller.
Return data is that where you. So I have one question about the alignment issues. So the read requests are coming in from where it start. Does that mean it's real aligned with the cache, or the page, or the block? If it's not. So there is some
expansion
or whatever, there's some issues there, right? That means that a particular, and that also the size, and offset, and actually is going to translate into multiple cache lines, possibly. That means the multiple implications.
That boundary problem, I think, should be taken care of in this function as well. I mean, the read...
Which function?
In the read from...
Read R from
SSD.
Read R from,
well,
SSD.
From SSD.
Yeah. That, because what happened here... So let's just take that. Take the path here.
So start, you send a request. Request is denoted as a capital R with offset and size. And suppose you have read cache, and you ask yourself whether the entire request is actually being cached, and it's not a particular cache line, because the entire cache, entire R, there could be partially cached and could be partially not cached, right? So obviously, it seems to me that needs to be taken care of at the very beginning. Yeah.
Not yes or no.
Right.
Maybe
the R consists of several cache lines, and they have to actually deal with the cache lines individually.
Yeah,
that's true. That will add another level of detail to this execution path.
But yeah, so that was just if you want to use this model, maybe you simulate the model or use some kind of later on the queuing model or whatever coming in. This is very nice to have since this is the execution plan.
Yes. Alright, what would you suggest to be the next step to refine this graph?
I would suggest that you expand the read R from device.
Well, yeah, definitely that's going
to
happen.
To, you know, address the parallel reads and also think about maybe before going into garbage collection and waiting for modeling that, maybe you can go into a similar write path. And my guess is that you will have the same function calls that need to be explored related to the garbage collection wait time in both these graphs, and then once we have these high level graphs refined, then we can go into that detail as well.
How's the just curious, how's the garbage collection actually involved with the read operation? Because is it background or is it
the background garbage collection can block the read calls.
The read from cache.
The read from the device.
From
the device.
That makes sense, yeah. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Now, this one is read from cache, so you don't need to do parallel reads. Or, well, actually, yeah, here also you have to split it up and things like that.
Just a separate cache?
Well, if it's cache in its entirety, then, yeah, I mean, this implies that you're going to read more than one entry in the cache.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Maybe you have to explore this further rather than this one.
Which one? The
decision point is our cache has to be further split.
Right. That's
fully or partially.
Yeah. Partial caches. And this definitely applies. Read from
SSD, from device.
From device, or I should use consistent notation here.
Read from, I think it's read from flash media or something like that. Because in each case, you're reading from the SSD, right? Even if you're reading from cache. Reading from flash media. Something like that.
Yes. And with the write and with the cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's enough.
I think modeling the cleaning would be. The waiting for the cleaning operation would be the challenging part.
Yeah. There's a rate. I mean, I'm more and more thinking of not really using the QM model, but rather using something like a FusionNet model. I mean, if later on we're going to expand this.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, because FusionNet actually provides more control, the command control, because the tokens going around. And actually that can be used to model something like that, although that's sort of like always done. But it works sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know anything
about Petrinet. So I will need some brief tutorial maybe next time we meet
from Shidong. But yeah, so yeah. Right, yeah. So at this point we don't need to get into that. Because FusionNet is more of a, just like operating system, you have to do something once you are synchronized with something else.
Mm-hmm.
The synchronization point would be, do you have available clean blocks? If you do,
mm-hmm.
that is represented as a token. Once I have the token, I can actually go around to do
mm-hmm.
something. So some of the models you can do is actually apply the stochastic about process.
Right.
Into how those tokens are being distributed around,
mm-hmm.
and actually simulate that and actually reflect what the system would look like.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but at this stage we don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
For this paper, I think we don't need that. I'm just sort of curious.
Would be interesting to bring something like that. Although I'm afraid that the audience that we are sending this to would probably be lost with the Petrinet stuff.
We're not going to describe them how these models will work.
Yeah.
We're going to describe it and say, look, it works.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the message you want to convey.
Yeah.
In the end, say, we have a simple model which we tweak a bunch of parameters and we can represent this using the parameters which we got from all these studies. And that will be the control. That will be the thing to add on. Maybe that's our Nexus symmetric paper. With all the equations.
Yeah.
One thing I think is important here is that we said last time that the garbage collection itself is not, within our scope for modeling purposes, right? I mean, that's something that happens somehow concurrently to the write operation. We know it's triggered by the write operation. It may happen on a different flash package, for example. But what I think is important here is how the interference with the write is. Right? So that's what I'm going to try to reflect in this type of graph.
Interference with the garbage collection.
With, yes. I mean,
for reads as well as writes.
For both, yeah, correct.
Yeah. And in each case, the interference is similar.
Mm-hmm.
The interference is that you do not have access to medium while the garbage collection is going on. In some cases, you can actually write in parallel or read in parallel because the garbage collection is on a different plane or die. But in other cases, you cannot. And the effect or the blocking effect for these read or write operations would be exactly the same.
Well, we have this different type of latencies, right? We saw as well in the CDS.
sometimes we wait longer, sometimes the wait is shorter. So that, I think, as well reflects that these operations happen
in parallel
sometimes, and some other times you pay the full price of waiting for the entire operation to complete.
Sometimes you pay the half price because the operation was already in progress when the read was issued. So those kinds of things that you can make as a function
block.
Or it's sort of a uniform distribution of across when so the garbage collection operation going on and when the read request can arrive. So this is something that we explored in some of our previous work, is that the time at which a request comes, is if it's a completely independent process, then it can arrive at any point during the garbage collection operation, either at the very beginning or at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
So in the average case, it arrives right in between. If the arrival is completely random and an independent process to the garbage collection. Right. So what you can say is that on an average, I have to wait for half the duration of a garbage collection operation. But in this case, it is also true that I have a read request that arrives when there is no garbage collection operation. With a certain probability, it arrives during a garbage collection operation and must wait for a garbage collection operation
mm-hmm.
for 1 minus the that probability.
Mm-hmm.
So these things you can model. And then the question really is, how do we get that probability? The more fragmented the system is, maybe the more likely that you will have to wait for a garbage collection.
Mm-hmm.
So some of those things can potentially be modeled, but of course, whether we can validate our model or not is a different question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can we reproduce this graph? Where is that graph now? This graph with our model.
Mm-hmm.
And we can argue that, well, for most of the times, you do not wait for garbage collection. I mean, or something like that, but you have to wait for certain other operations. If we produce a distribution that is similar to this distribution, I think that's really great.
I think we can. Once we actually sort of finalizing the functional block, if there are things that you don't want to model that in detail, just like what you said, uniform distribution or some kind of empirical PDF, CDF, whatever we can use, make use in terms of extracting the timing details. And I think it's important to have a full diagram of all these things. And in the end, I think we can actually try to pull it, I mean, for the next step, to pull out the model out of this. And I think there is a really good chance to really get a fairly good model and being seeded by all these experiment results that we have.
Yeah, I mean, we don't need to reproduce the timeline. If you reproduce the distribution, it's good enough.
So timeline is the same thing. It's just a stochastic process, and they're not going to look exactly the same. But
I mean, I'm saying it doesn't have to be synchronized with this
we
see here, and it's probably very hard to synchronize. But if we have a distribution that looks similar to what we want to do, it's good enough.
Cool.
All right. So I guess Ariel, you can continue with building the right
the second part
and
Ken and this the read operations first, which is
it's
another block diagram like this.
Yeah.
But
it's good. I think it's good that you're taking the fractal approach, that you compartmentalize and modularize the different
concerns.
Good.
And now we have some numbers. See how much discussion we can have once we have numbers. Very good. That's very good. So when are we going to get